that is impossible that anything should be compromised. I know even years ago, in traveling in Japan, in one place where I was, I threw away a pair of shoes, dropped them in the wastebasket, didn't want them any longer. Those shoes followed me all over the Japanese Empire. I couldn't get rid of them. Each hotel I came to, the shoes were waiting for me. You could take a pocketbook or a wallet with a lot of money in it, lay it on the edge of a desk somewhere, and go away for a week. When you came back, it would be there. Why? Because the proprietor was an Amidist. He was dedicated. Now, this dedication didn't prevent him from being a good proprietor or making a reasonable living, but he would not touch anything that was not his own. Now, these are the integrities of discipleship, and they must be present if the individual wishes to transform theoretical knowledge into spiritual experience. These changes have to come as a result of growth inside the person. And when that growth comes, it doesn't make very much difference whether there are any schools available or not. The whole growth takes place inside the person. Once his dedication to an idea that is bigger than he previously had is firmly established and he lives it, he grows as nature grows. He grows like the lily of the field and the rose of Sharon. He grows because growth is natural to all that lives. It is human sophistication that blocks growth and transforms a beautiful experience into a deadly monotony of careers. So each person has this parallel job to take care of. He can read all the texts he wants to and find out all about the great mysteries of existence. But the only thing that can help him to solve his problem is to work upon the inconsistencies and intemperances of his own nature. Actually, if he begins this procedure, he finds out that it has a tremendous therapy. When it comes to discipline, the hardest step is the first one, because the first one has to be taken on faith. You say to yourself that you're going to do it better, you're going to hope that something good will happen. This you have to take on faith. But the moment you have made the first step, the effects begin to develop themselves. In a very short time, you begin to realize that instead of being one of the most difficult decisions to make, dedication is the easiest, and its results are most immediately apparent and enduring. In a very short time, discipline can affect every phase of your life constructively. It can bring better health. It can bring peace to the home. It can relieve you from dissensions in business. It can get away from all the intemperances and problems of political structures today. A little discipline, and you begin to digest better. You sleep better. You're also more moderate in your desires. You do not have the tendency to go in debt. We now have a very large, difficult situation of the abuse of credit cards. The individual thinks he has money in the bank as long as he has a credit card. This wouldn't happen with a good yoga background, because no yogi would use a credit card that way. In fact, he probably wouldn't use one at all, because there's nothing he needs. But presuming that you are a disciplined person, you can use all of these privileges and make life a little simpler and easier. But without discipline, everything is perverted. And without the gradual discipline, the wisdom of life itself has no chance of taking over. You cannot do the things that are necessary to be done. Another important point about discipline that I think is very valuable is that whereas we think very largely of discipline as a specialized skill, and actually, discipline is by far less intensely specialized than most of our career problems. Discipline doesn't mean that you can only do one thing. And as a result of being tied up with a monorail type of consciousness and with life is centered upon one thing alone, you get intensity, but you do not get discipline. Discipline is something that can be transferred from one object to another almost instantly and be equally valuable in all relationships. Discipline can make you work harder when you're working. It can make you rest better when you rest. It can prevent you from becoming so one-pointed that you lose interest in everything else in life. It helps you to escape from the tremendous pressures of career, which have a tendency to narrow and limit everything that you do. Discipline tells you when to pick up the career and when to lay it down. Discipline will prevent you from bringing the job home. It will enable you to solve it where it should be solved. Little by little, discipline enlarges your foundation. It gives you time and skills for art, for music, for every type of thing. But always, wherever you have a skill, you have a discipline. And where the greatest of all disciplines is the discipline of living, then you have the greatest of all skills. If then you are really interested, then I think one of the things to do for everyone is to begin with a very simple understanding. If you are in doubt and you do not know just exactly what to do about some of these things, then probably start with something like the Sermon on the Mount or with the various words of Christ as recorded in the New Testament. Simple admonitions to love one another and work with them until you've solved them. Remember that the meek are the blessed, for they shall inherit the earth. Get away from the false sophistications of things. Take the simple facts of life. That if you cannot love your brother whom you have seen, you cannot love your God whom you have not seen. And many people who cannot speaking with their brother at all are quite certain they're deeply in love with God. They haven't learned the lesson. They haven't picked it up at all. So take the simple things first. I saw a little note in the paper not long ago that I thought was rather cute. And that is that it has taken 35 million laws to enforce the Ten Commandments. And still not enforced. Just imagine what would happen if the average person simply settled down quietly and said, I don't care what's on the books. I believe in the Ten Commandments and I'm going to live them. It would change the whole destiny of the world. But it would interfere to a certain degree with a lot of personal ambitions. It doesn't sound very spiritual. That's another problem we have. Things have to sound spiritual, whether they are or not. If they're glamorous, they sound spiritual. And if they're not glamorous, they sound more like hard work. Well, growing is hard work, and always will be. But it's very rewarding work. It's like a farmer with a good field. It takes a lot of work to bring in the harvest, but it's a good harvest if he brings it in. Everywhere in this problem, we have the constant need for getting down to the simple, direct practices of the principles of integrity. Now, we don't have to read great, long, elaborate treatises to find out what these integrities are. They are practically written in the air, they're in the sky, they're everywhere. But once we have gotten to love them, have gotten to understand them and stand with them, once we have become associated vitally with them, our entire relationships with life change. Then if we want to go on, there are all kinds of ways in which we can expand knowledge and do new things and involve new projects. And there's also the final work that the teacher has to do, and that is to take the understanding that he has and help to apply it to the problems of those who come for help. He has to try to show what is necessary, and he will have to show by very simple means that the individual must keep the rules if he wants to get the results. I knew an old doctor who was a very fine old man. He was a very sincere physician, one of the old school. So he said unto me one day, he said, man comes to me, he's got a stomachache. I said to him, George, you know why you have that stomachache? He said, yes, I guess I do. You don't eat right. You don't think right. You don't live right. How do you expect your digestion to be any good? Yes, I guess there's some truth in that. So I'm going a little further. The man says to him, well, Doc, can't you give me a little something for that stomachache? A little baking soda, maybe? Doctor says, yes. You'll be back next week with a stomachache again. Says, you don't want to get well. All you want to do is to have your stomach stop telling you what's wrong with you. What it is. It's just the problem of the individual doesn't really want to change. He wants to do as he pleases and escape the consequences. This is what has created and maintained and amplified the aspirin industry. Everyone wants to stop hurting, but no one wants to behave. Now, this might sound like a little exaggeration, but it is true in principle, because if we wanted to behave, we would. And religion, philosophy, all these things arise from the common grounds of the individual wanting to improve, to be better, to accomplish more, to be more useful, to be more satisfied with himself, to have a sense of internal dignities and values. These things have to come through discipline. So if someone comes to you and brings their problem, you can probably, after a little while, by looking back on your own life, you can say to this individual, I think I see what the trouble is. Now, I can't cure it for you, but I can tell you what I did for myself with it. Maybe it'll help you too. And try wherever possible to advise what has worked for you. And if you've never tried it yourself, be a little slow to recommend it to somebody else. Especially if you know you should have tried it. So try to always advise from the basis of achieved experience. And if your own experience is not quite adequate, then try to gather some other help from sources of similar attitudes and similar concepts. If you want to try to find natural ways of healing, work with natural healing methods. And find out, as all do in time, that there are rules governing these things. Now, the person who is a spiritually successful person is not one who has accomplished all kinds of outside things. It is the individual who is able to daily maintain serenity of spirit and continued usefulness. Now, another problem we have in this field very often is this lack of usefulness. The individual who sees a little light somewhere wants to sit back and pontificate about it. They want to go and have other people sit and listen to them tell about it. This is not the real answer to the thing at all. If we have a little bit more light, a little bit more of insight than we had before, we must be useful. Too many persons reaching retirement age think of rest as freedom from labor. It is not. The only thing that results from freedom from labor is boredom. What we really need to do is to take the new information that is coming to us and do something with it. Now, we may not always know just what to do. And in a very highly complicated civilization like this, there are many times when it's almost impossible to figure out what we can do, but we must try. And there's always something we can do. Everyone who would become enlightened must become a server. They must do something. They must help those in trouble. If all they can do is go next door and help a sick person take care of their house, there's got to be action. There's got to be dedication and, in a sense, Our service of others is a penance for our own mistakes. We can and should never try to learn unless learning impels us to help now. Learning that locks us in a room with a book is not the kind of learning we need. The kind of learning is to read one line of the book and go out and work all day. Do something with what we know. Help in some way. Help in helping those who are in trouble. The world is full of problems these days. And each person who grows must at the same time ask very devoutly, very simply, very honestly, what can I do with what I'm learning? How can I prove my dedication by using what I know for the greater glory of truth? We have to think this at this at all times. There must be effort. We cannot simply pile up knowledge in the mind or pile up good feelings in the heart. We've got to do something with them. They've got to go out and serve. They must some way make a better world. And if we can do that, then we will be able to really instruct people in the proper manner. So when you grow, if you are teaching, to always find out what the individual is doing to help. Find out what they are doing every day for someone else. What sacrifice they may be making of some time or effort to make life better for someone else. And also, are they growing unselfishly, or are they growing like misers, trying to store up some kind of knowledge that others do not have? Are they trying to develop some kind of a sense of superiority? Does wisdom mean to them a social advancement? Does it mean they become part of a spiritual aristocracy of some kind? If this is the attitude, they've missed the boat entirely. The purpose of it is very definite, that those who would be the greatest among us must be the servants of all. Service is the great keynote for transforming theoretical knowledge into eternal fact. So it is very necessary for the individual, whenever instruction is given, to have a job given with it, something to do. Now, sometimes it may only be that they'll have to try to do something for someone in their family who is in need at that moment. Maybe they can't go out into the larger circle of things. But if there is someone who is unhappy, someone who is in need, someone who is lonely, someone who is neglected, then the person who is growing begins to feel the emotional pull to bring peace and comfort and thought and hope to this other person. Now, it may well be that the other person won't even appreciate it. This is another little trick that has to be considered. But whether the other person appreciates it or not has nothing to do with the case. The problem is that it is our duty to do that which we feel is right. If it's rejected, that is the other person's burden. But we do not do it for soap of reward to ourselves, or to be patted on the back and told how wonderful we are. We do it because there is a need. And if the person we're doing it for doesn't know that need, that is not our responsibility. It is never permitted that we fail simply because someone else fails us. Everyone can fail us, but one, and that is deity, and that cannot fail. Otherwise, we are to serve as it is given to us to see, to do that which we find is useful. Now, when you come to a more formal system, people might and probably do want some kind of little simple guidelines to help them in their growing. And working with the problem over the many, many years, I've found that it seems to me that there are two systems, basic systems, that have extraordinary advantages. Now, I've been criticized on a lot of occasions on the ground that I do not properly emphasize other people's faults. In other words, if I'm interested in someone like Plato, I do not bring out all the possible weaknesses of the man, although I assume them. I don't think it is necessary to go into a deep biographical discussion of the weaning of Plato, or that it was necessary for Plato to have summer complaint while he was an infant. These things don't mean anything. What we do is to pick out the achievements of the person that are most outstanding, and we measure the individual by the best that he was. We assume he's not going to be that good all over. The same is true of all teaching. We can criticize and condemn and turn away from something for some small mistakes. It is said Aristotle never knew how many teeth there were in the human head, but that isn't very much important. The important thing is his great essay on metaphysics, which is one of the best things that the world has ever had. So we take the good, and we don't tear down the individual or try to belittle him, because we're all in the same boat. Now, in studying these things, I have come to the conclusion that, broadly speaking, Neoplatonism, as it developed in Alexandria and Athens, in the perfection of the theology of Plato, the original works having been lost, is probably one of the most important descents of Western mysticism. It is a magnificent moral ethical structure with no limitations or restrictions that are obviously difficult. For the Eastern systems, I like Mahayana Buddhism because it represents probably one of the most completely idealistic systems that we have. It is free from most of the confusions and discords that have affected religions from early times. These two systems seem to suggest a practical background of self-discipline. Both of these systems emphasize simple living. They reward the journey of the truth seeker in terms of the journey inward to self and to that which lies at the root of life. Both systems emphasize that the source of reality is within us and not on the outside, that the journey is always through the levels of our own limitation to the limitless reality that is at the core. We are therefore always on this journey toward the real. And this journey toward the real is through a series of simple renunciations of false values, the gradual, gentle conquest of the mistakes in our own temperaments, the gradual cleansing of the imperfections of mind and heart and body, and the dedication of every resource that we possess to the service of the human need. These simple principles protect us in a great way. Both of these schools were very humble. Neither one of them had any great emphasis upon worldly success. They were not trying to make famous people. They were trying to help average persons to find the eternal verities without which we can never fulfill our destinies. So these two systems have always had a great interest for me philosophically. And between these systems and in other systems brought together, we also come to the principal contribution of Christianity to this system. Christianity is essentially mysticism. Christianity is an internal experience of the mystery of infinite benevolence. It is the inner experience of the absolute unconditioned love of God for all that exists. And it is to be copied or to be reproduced in human action by the individual loving his neighbor, his brother, and his world. So the direct experience of love is a Christian mysticism. The direct experience of enlightened wisdom impelling to love is both Platonic and Buddhistic. Altogether, they form a kind of victorious triumphate of powers, through the understanding of which the life of the average individual can be simple and reconciled. These major systems have stood the test of ages. They have stood the problems of centuries. They come down to us with their substances intact. And they also tell us very simply that all wisdom, all the things we are trying to do, are summed up in the simple experience of love, the divine love for all that lives. And that's where we truly love, not as personal life love, which is only an aspect of it, but as a complete love of truth, love of God, love of humanity, love of beauty, love of wisdom, all these unqualified dedications of unselfish love to the objectives of existence. In these areas, we achieve the highest form of mystical insight. There is really no need for mystery. There is no need for any kind of strange secrets. The secret thing, of course, if there is a secret, is that the love that we talk about in mysticism can only be experienced. It can never be communicated. It is something that can happen, and no one has ever been able to define what happens. But it is a sudden sense of at-one-ment, a sudden sense of complete unification with the infinite benevolence of deity. And moving, living, guiding, hoping in this atmosphere, we go on through life in a very simple and gentle way. And having broken no laws in our own daily conduct, we come in the end to release from all of the debtedness with which most persons' lives are burdened. It is a very simple and reasonable way of approaching this problem. And it means that the disciple who wants to learn must try to find the simple contact with the teacher. In the Indian teaching system, the contact is simply that the disciple has genuine sympathy, follows the instructions, and achieves the ends. And the teacher, in turn, is extremely careful never to communicate anything which can possibly result in further complications for the disciple. He will not tell the disciple more than the disciple can use. The moment he tells him too much, he will abuse. The moment he tells him something not understood, the disciple will misunderstand. So that it all begins with a very simple, gentle method of instruction, such as you would use with a child. That you learn that they teach the child its alphabets first. That you teach the child the simple lessons of daily conduct. Because discipleship is another kind of childhood. It is a growing up in grace rather than in body. It is a growing up in insights and in understanding rather than in physical form alone. But every disciple starts a new infancy when he puts his feet upon the path that leads to enlightenment. He becomes again as a little child, growing up in a different kind of world, learning a different kind of lesson, and coming in the end to a mature and completely satisfying realization of values. Until this is accomplished, the discipleship is not complete. So that with thoughtful persons who have already advanced somewhat in these matters, a discipleship can be set up by the individual himself. He can be a disciple to his own integrity. He can be a disciple to the enlarging vision of his own inner life. He can follow the rules and laws which he has set down for himself as being necessary to his own salvation. These things can all be accomplished, and the individual will grow naturally and simply and honestly, and there'll be no strange mysteries, no fantastic phenomena associated with it. It'll be a simple growth, day by day, toward the light. And in the course of a lifetime, this goes a long way. And the moment the individual really gets himself into the pattern of things, he will never leave that pattern. And though he may require many embodiments to complete it, once he puts his feet upon the path, makes his dedication to his own higher self, he will continue to grow until the final desired end is achieved. This is absolutely part of the plan and is invariable. Well, I think that's all for this morning, folks. Thank you very much.